RN, this is Counterpoint. Hello, I'm Paul Comrie-Thompson.
And I'm Michael Duffy. Well, just about every industry group uses them, but just how credible are they? First up today, we're talking about economic models with Richard Dennis. He says while they're potentially a useful tool, he's deeply sceptical about how they are used in the political debate. We'll be examining the multiplier effect and some of the claims made by the mining, automotive and gambling industries.
Also today, we welcome back for 2012 our regular contributor on US politics and business, the Wall Street Journal's Mary Kissel. Right now, all eyes are on the Republicans as their candidates crisscross America, attempting to get the 1,144 delegate votes necessary to secure their party's nomination at the National Convention in August.
And talking of eager beavers, we're also going to have a look at motivation. Just what is it that drives most of us? Many people think it's money, but our guest Daniel Pink says, think again. He's written a number of books about the changing world of work.
His most recent publication is Drive: The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. When you're talking about routine mechanical tasks, sure, money gets results. But is it still the case when cognitive or creative skills are called for? That's later today on Counterpoint.
But we begin with economic modelling. Recently we've heard the mining and automotive industries make claims about just how many people they employ, both directly and indirectly. Such claims are often made by industries seeking to influence public policy, and they're usually based on some sort of economic modelling. Richard Dennis runs the Australia Institute, and he's just published a paper called The Use and Abuse of Economic Modelling in Australia, A User's Guide to Tricks of the Trade. So, just what is modelling, and what are some of its main uses?
Look, an economic model, any model is a sort of a simplified representation of something. So a model car or a model train is something that allows you to look at something small and think about something big. And an economic model is has the same objective, but it's actually, this will sound strange, but it's actually a sort of a set of equations, a set of relationships. So when we say we're modelling the economy, what we mean to say is, well, we've got a pretty good idea of the relationship, for example, between economic growth and employment. And history tells us that when GDP grows fast, employment grows fast. And when GDP slows down or goes into recession, unemployment starts to rise rapidly. So basically, economists... we've got lots of data on these relationships, and we've got lots of theory about what we think drives what, so what the direction of cause and effect is. Frankly, we just put those all together and call that our model.
And you could use these models presumably to make predictions, can't you, about what might happen if there are certain changes?
Yeah, look, the prediction part, yes, that's part of modelling, but there aren't many modellers who would say that their model is great at telling you what house prices will be in 10 years' time, or even what GDP will be in 2 years' time. But where they're very good at making predictions is saying, well, if the economy does speed up to 4%, what will that do to inflation? What will that do to employment? What will that do to the current account deficit? So, again, the strength of the models is not a crystal ball, but more perhaps shedding light on some unexpected relationships. So if you make an assumption about what economic growth will look like, if we make an assumption about whether there'll be another GFC or not, a model's not a bad way to say, well, if that happens, here's 20 other things that are likely to happen that you probably wouldn't have thought of.
Well, that sounds to me like a qualified prediction.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's based, I guess, on the original, you know, do you think there'll be another GFC?
Oh, of course.
The model won't ever predict that.
Although it might predict there would be a GFC if certain other things happened, from
yes.
what you're saying. And have these been tested over time? I mean, do we have some idea of the effectiveness of models in general, or maybe specific models?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the modellers are perpetually refining them. And I have to be careful here. I mean, economic modelling, I think, is actually potentially quite a useful tool. I mean, used sensibly by sincere people, it sheds far more light on a lot of relationships than anyone's common sense ever will. So, no, it's the job of the modellers to refine them and to make them more accurate. And when new things happen, they, you know, they sit down and they try to improve their model. So it's, again, it's, I mean, I'm deeply skeptical about the way these things are used in the political debate, but I'm not as skeptical about them being used modestly by sensible people when talking to other people who understand the models.
Mm. And I suppose, without going into the details, that over time, economists have now worked out that some models or some things in an economy can be modelled more usefully than others. I mean, economies obviously are incredibly complicated.
Well, they are, but the reality is, if we were having this conversation in 1980, and you asked a modeller, you know, how many people will work in the mobile phone industry in 2011, you'd forecast zero. Or if in 1990 someone was going to model how many people would work in the internet industry in 2011 or 2012, the answer would be zero. You know, we often confuse precision with accuracy. These models knock out numbers with decimal places in front of them. But, you know, the reality is the models are based on old relationships between things. And when new things come along, which they have a habit of doing, you know, it fundamentally changes things. And again, used modestly, not the end of the world. But when you hear someone saying, if the government introduces this policy today, then by 2020, 23,842 people will lose their jobs. I mean, really, just switch off. Don't even engage. It's not worth. It's not worth the paper it's printed on.
But having said that, when used properly, and they often are used properly, they're a valuable tool in a great deal of policy discussion and planning.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, used honestly by sincere people who understand these limitations as well as I do. If I had the choice between, you know, a cabinet sitting around or three public servants sitting around and saying, well, what do you think it'll do? Or what do you think it will do? You know, a model gives people a good place to start a conversation about unexpected relationships and possible orders of magnitude of effects. But again, there's a difference between a good place to start a conversation and the way it's used these days as the final word. Well, my modelling shows this, you know, and where's your modelling? You don't have modelling, so you don't have a legitimate voice in this debate.
Right, okay. Well, look, that's the sort of positive side of it. Let's turn now to some of the abuses which you've documented in your paper. And the one I'm particularly interested in is the multiplier effect, which is often claimed by various industries as a reason why they need some sort of good treatment, special treatment, whatever. Can you tell us about the multiplier effect, and is that a model in itself, or is it an assumption that's used in modelling?
Well, it's a simple question, but it's hard to answer. The multiplier effect does exist. When I undertake certain activity, if I buy a coffee in the morning, or I buy a car, or probably more significantly, if the federal government buys 10,000 cars in a fleet, or you build $50 billion worth of submarines in South Australia, there's no doubt that those activities will influence economic activity in other sectors. And multipliers come from something called the ABS input-output tables. And what they do is they show the historic relationship. So it's, again, it's based on the past. They show the historic relationship between what happens to demand for steel if demand for cars or production of cars goes up. Because historically, we know this. If Ford doubles their output, we can, using the existing data, say, well, last time they doubled their output, here's what the impact on demand for steel would be. So the multiplier effect is input-output multipliers are a form of modelling, and those relationships are built into the bigger macroeconomic models. But again, they're based on the past. They assume that the thing we're looking at today in some way analogous to what's happened in the past. So if a car company increases its output today, then that increase in output is similar to the increase in output of 10 years ago. So lots of assumptions there, but again, a good place to start an examination.
Well, can you tell us a bit about the mining industry? Because I think you have claimed that they have exaggerated or even misused the multiplier effect when it comes to employment in mining.
Look, we actually did a survey a little while ago and we asked people, how many people do you think work in the mining industry? Now, the actual answer is about 2% of GDP. And according to 1,000 Australians, they thought it was 16% of GDP. Mm. They were 800% out. And this is partly because the mining industry has been so good at talking itself up. You know, we hear $30 billion project this, $50 billion project that. What they mean when they say $30 billion project, by the way, is if we sell gas for 20 years, we'll get $30 billion. So what they meant to say was $1.5 billion a year project. Mm. They're very good at sort of talking themselves up, and one of the ways they do that is they just make this claim, they've made it again and again, that for every mining job, they create at least three non-mining jobs, and they claim that that's based on the ABS input-output multipliers. Now, firstly, that's an exaggeration of the ABS input-output multiplier, it's smaller than three. Secondly, the ABS says that their multipliers will typically exaggerate the size. And thirdly, and most significantly, what happens with these simplistic multiplier analyses is they make the classic economist assumption of ceteris paribus, all other things being equal. And that is, well, if I expand my output and nothing else changes in any other sector of the economy, here is what would happen in other sectors of the economy. It's a bit of a strange assumption to make. But we know, for example, that the mining boom has driven the exchange rate up to record levels. And we know, for example, that the reason the manufacturing industry, one of the reasons it's in trouble, is because of a high exchange rate. Same for tourism, same for the education export market. So in reality, a big expansion in the mining industry, in economic language, crowds out some activity in other sectors. So to some extent, for every mining job created, a part of a job is lost somewhere else. And really, if we're serious about it, we have to have a look at the net effect. Now, interestingly, Clive Palmer, who's building the world's biggest coal mine in Queensland, did some macroeconomic modelling, and his modelling, I don't think he meant anyone to actually read it, but his modelling shows that for the 6,000 jobs that he thinks his mine will create, 3,000 jobs will be lost in manufacturing. So according to one miner, for every two jobs in mining, one job is lost in manufacturing. But the standard press release from the mining industry says for every one job in mining, three jobs are created. So you'd at least think they could caucus a bit.
And also, I suppose a certain amount of exaggeration is written into the DNA of miners, isn't it? I mean, exaggeration and optimism, it's sort of built into the whole industry. But health, I was interested to see that the multiplier effect in health is actually much bigger than for mining.
Oh, it's huge. And the community service sector has very big impacts. And so really, what the ABS data tells us is that if you were going to spend $1 million on a new activity, mining would be about the worst place to spend it, if your goal was to create jobs. And that's a big if, but, you know, everyone's running around saying jobs, jobs, jobs all the time. So if you wanted to create jobs, if you spend $1 million in mining, you'll create very few jobs. If you spend $1 million in health services, you'll create a lot. And that's for a very simple reason. Health is a very labour-intensive service. Aged care homes, nursing homes, and hospitals even are very labour-intensive, luckily. I mean, we need physical care when we're in pain. Mm. Whereas mining is, of course, the exact opposite. I mean, every time you see one of those enormous trucks, you just saw an industry that's trying not to employ many people. Mm. I mean, if they really wanted to create lots of jobs in mining, there'd be lots of people driving little trucks.
Talking of trucks, can we now move to the automobile industry, talking of cars anyway. Have they also been guilty of exaggerating the multiplier effect as it relates to them?
Oh, look, I think almost any industry that is running around using sort of simplistic multipliers is probably engaged in some form of exaggeration. My point about the mining industry is quite specific, though. I've looked at the ABS multiplier for mining and compared it to what they've said, and I know it's an exaggeration. I haven't done that for manufacturing yet. We're looking, you know, more into this. But again, as I said before, the ABS applies those same caveats to the use of all of its multipliers, that they inherently tend to exaggerate and they ignore those crowding out type effects. So, look, I don't blame industry advocates for making these arguments, and I'm not saying we should shut down the mining industry, and I'm not saying we should shut down the manufacturing industry, but what I'm saying is, you know, when it's an advocate spruiking a model, you probably want to be a bit dubious.
Do you know if anyone's ever sat down and put all the multiplier effects together to see if it leads to this, the existing size of the Australian workforce, or in fact something much larger?
The irony is, or the sad reality is, it's only a small number of industries who make these claims, and that's kind of why they've got away with it for so long. So, typically, the mining industry and the farming industry have been the best at using multipliers to make what are in fact quite small workforces look very small, look a lot larger. So, you know, the miners only employ 200,000 people out of a population of 20 million. They need the multiplier effect. The manufacturing industry, even though we think it's a basket case, still employs a million people. So they don't usually use the multiplier effect. So while every industry hasn't commissioned one, we've done it for everybody. And basically, if every industry were to go and commission an economists to calculate the size of their contribution to employment, then the labour force would be 187% of its current size. Okay. So, you know, if they all went through the motions of claiming credit for each other's jobs, which is effectively what this is, it's, you know, when the mining industry says, but we create, you know, 600,000 jobs elsewhere, what they're really trying to say is you need to take 600,000 jobs out of what the ABS says belong in another industry and give them to us. But when every industry is taking and no one's giving, you get these absurd conclusions.
It's a fabulous figure. One question about modelling, maybe more generally, the gambling industry. Now, they've argued that the introduction of mandatory pre-commitment technology would cost up to $5 billion. There'd be a need to replace, I think, or repair about 200,000 poker machines, and also lead to substantial job losses in hotels. What have you got to say about those figures?
Well, look, I mean, those figures are so fanciful that it's really an insult to even call them modelling. But I guess it shows how powerful a confidently asserted number can be in a public policy debate. I mean, the overwhelming number of Australians think that we should do something about problem gambling, but no one in Australia, or not many people in Australia, are determined to drive every club out of business and sack tens of thousands of bar staff. So the clubs industry has done a good job of saying, well, if this goes ahead, look, it's going to cost $5 billion. And just to sort of show you how I think we need to subject these things to a bit more scrutiny, what that $5 billion figure is the cost of having to upgrade and replace every poker machine in Australia virtually overnight. And, you know, basically there's 200,000 poker machines in Australia, and the clubs say they're $25,000 each. And if you multiply 200,000 by 25,000, you get $5 billion. So the point is, you know, that multiplication is true, but $5 billion is the cost of doing something that no one is proposing to do. What's been proposed is that as poker machines wear out, they should be replaced by ones with different characteristics, and the cost of doing that is near zero.
Richard, is there anything that can be done about this? I mean, you've written this paper, and good on you, but is there any hope for the average citizen, those of us out here who hear these amazing figures, which, as you just suggested, they do tend to hang around?
Well, it's a bit scary. There was an editor in the New York Times recently. He's the reader's editor or something, and he asked the readers, did the readers think that the New York Times should check the fact, check the claims made by politicians before they reported them? And the website went into meltdown with readers saying, and I'm being polite because we're on radio, but effectively, dear God, what have I been paying you for? What is it you actually do? So I do think that the public believes that these claims are subject to some form of scrutiny before they're reported. And I know journalists are busy, and I know it's a complex market these days, but one way for the media to play a valuable service that people will pay for is to actually do their homework on these things. And unfortunately, some journalists will say, Richard, I do report the facts. The fact is they claimed that, mm-hmm. and I reported that fact. And that's true in some banal sense. But I guess what I'm saying is we all need to, I think we all need to not get so cynical that we don't believe anything. That's not going to help at all.
No.
But we all need to, I think, expect other people, people we delegate responsibility to ask some simple questions like, how on earth did you come up with that $5 billion figure?
Fascinating stuff. Richard, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Richard Dennis runs the Australia Institute, and the paper we've been discussing, which he's written, is The Use and Abuse of Economic Modelling in Australia, A User's Guide to Tricks of the Trade.
We'll post a link to that paper on the Counterpoint website. That's abc.net.au/radionational/counterpoint. And Michael, as a coda to that story, Ross Gittins wrote recently in the Fairfax Press, and I am quoting directly here, "Such models should only be used in private by consenting economists."
Your world unfolding.